Welcome, everyone, and thank you for coming to the 13th Annual Gerald Lynn Hilleman Lecture. I'm Julie Rogers-Smith. I'm with the CDC Foundation. As many of you may know, the CDC Foundation is a private nonprofit organization that was chartered by Congress to facilitate partnerships between the private sector and CDC. This is one of our favorite events. It's an endowment that the Merck Company Foundation started in 1995 to honor CDC's 50th anniversary and the 25th anniversary of the first combination vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella. The lectureship is named for the daughter of Maurice Hilleman, who's often credited with saving more lives than any other scientist in the past century. Dr. Hilleman is widely regarded as the world's foremost vaccine developer, which makes CDC's annual National Immunization Conference the perfect place to showcase talent in the current talent in the field. The CDC Foundation and the Merck Company Foundation and Merck have been together for several years doing this lectureship, and I'd like to introduce Dr. Mark Feinberg, who's the Vice President of Medical Affairs and Policy for the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Division.
Thanks very much, Julie. It's a great pleasure and honor for me to be able to introduce you to this year's Gerald Lynn Hilleman Endowed Lecture, and in particular to Dr. Tony Fauci, who we're very fortunate to have as this year's speaker. As you all know, Dr. Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the NIH. Whether or not you've heard Dr. Fauci speak in person before, I'm sure you've all seen him as the voice of reason, insight, and clarity in the national media whenever issues at the interface between science and public health arise. I cannot even begin to count the number of times my mother would call me when she saw Dr. Fauci on the television saying, "I saw that nice Dr. Fauci again. He speaks so clearly and well," she would say. Then she would go on at a time when my hair was much longer than it is today to tell me what a nice haircut he had and that I should get one just like it. If I were to give a thorough introduction of Dr. Fauci, it would take up all the allotted time this evening, so I'm not going to do that, and even if I did, I would just be getting started. I won't list all of his tremendous scientific accomplishments. I won't talk to you about his over 1,100 publications or 30-some honorary doctoral degrees from universities around the world, nor will I talk about many of his prestigious awards. But to give you a brief flavor of that, you can read about it in the conference's program. There you'll read about his major contributions to our basic understanding of the human immune system and how he applied those important contributions to come up with effective immune-based therapies for immune-mediated diseases such as polyarteritis nodosa and Wegener's granulomatosis, which previously had been untreatable and often fatal diseases. Nor will you have the opportunity to go into much detail in my introduction about the tremendous contributions Dr. Fauci has made to our basic understanding of AIDS pathogenesis and how we transform those concepts into effective therapies and hopefully one day an effective vaccine. Any one of these contributions by any one individual would be truly remarkable. The fact that they were accomplished all by one individual is really kind of amazing to me. Given the limitations that are posed on introducing someone who's as innovative, influential, and broadly engaged as Dr. Fauci, I'm just going to focus my remarks on some personal recollections and some of the things that you won't learn from his bio sketch about him, and just how important a role he has played in being a champion of science and public health and in navigating our nation's approach to many challenging and often politically charged circumstances, always striving to achieve the right outcome. I first met Tony Fauci 25 years ago in 1984. That was the year when he assumed directorship of the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Think back about 25 years ago. AIDS was a new disease, just having been described 3 years previously, and the infectious etiology of it had just been identified the previous year. Good timing. Think about the circumstances, though. I mean, Ronald Reagan was president, and he had not yet mentioned the disease. Flash forward 25 years, we now know what a tremendous, terrible impact the AIDS pandemic has had on the lives of many millions of people around the world, but it is being approached by the scientific, medical, public health communities and by governments and non-governmental organizations in a manner unprecedented in the history of infectious diseases. Barack Obama is now president, and AIDS research and treatment are major priorities of the U.S. government. So many things have changed, but one thing is constant, and that is Dr. Fauci has been a reliable, energetic voice for science, compassion, and public health principles in our government's approach to infectious diseases, be it AIDS, emerging infectious diseases, pandemic influenza, or bioterrorism. He has been one of the key people our nation's leaders turn to for advice. With each of the great diversity of presidents he has interacted with, he has managed to adhere to his principles, to be respected, to be listened to, and to make a real difference. That is truly a remarkable feat. In the time I've known Dr. Fauci, I've had the great opportunity to directly see and to work with him in his role as a very innovative scientist, as a very wise and compassionate physician caring for people with life-threatening diseases, and as an exceptionally talented and effective administrator, as a voice of common reason in uncertain times, and as an unrelenting champion of public health. Of the numerous prestigious awards for his scientific and public health accomplishments that Dr. Fauci has received, I just want to mention one of them and to tell you some things that Tony probably wouldn't say himself, and that is his receipt of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, an award that Dr. Fauci received last year. You may not know this, but this is the highest civil award that the United States government offers. In the citation, the president noted that Dr. Fauci has, in quotes, dedicated his life to expanding the horizons of human knowledge. His efforts to advance our understanding and treatment of HIV/AIDS have brought hope and healing to millions around the world. While this award is impressive, it is what Dr. Fauci did that means millions for people around the world that is really impressive. Dr. Fauci served as the essential driving force behind the conceptualization and implementation of PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. I believe this is now by far the largest and most significant healthcare-focused mechanism for foreign assistance in history, accomplished remarkably in an administration that had not previously been considered public health and AIDS as priority areas for foreign aid. PEPFAR is now providing HIV treatment for over 2 million men, women, and children, and has supported the provision of healthcare and other services to more than 10 million people, including more than 4 million orphans. TB treatment has been provided to over 500,000 people. 57 million people have benefited from HIV counseling and testing services. PEPFAR has recently been reauthorized and now has a budget of $48 billion for HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria around the world. This program will undoubtedly save millions of lives. People living with HIV and other terrible infectious diseases in difficult circumstances in very poor countries, people who would otherwise have been without hope. While Dr. Fauci will not say this, I will. Without his leadership and intervention, this program would not exist. Many thousands of people are alive today and will be alive in the future who otherwise would not have been. Basic science discovery, clinical care innovator, leading administrator, able interpreter of science and medicine to the public, trusted counsel to numerous presidents, champion of providing AIDS care and prevention around the world. It is no wonder that Dr. Maurice Hellman held Dr. Fauci in such very high regard. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to welcome here this evening, and it is also before Dr. Fauci's talk, I want to introduce you first to Dr. Anne Schuchat, who is someone who I know you all know and respect as much as I do. She is, as you know, the Deputy Director for Science and Program in an interim basis in a very significant leadership role at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. You all know Dr. Schuchat as a clear, committed, and visionary leader who's someone who's been a real champion of immunization during her leadership at the immunization program and herself a great public health champion. Anne.
Thank you, Mark, and let me again welcome everyone. The folks who are standing in the back, if you come down, there's still some chairs over here, and I really encourage you to come and have a seat. This is going to be a fantastic presentation, and I'd love to get you comfortable for it. I just want to supplement Mark's wonderful introduction with a few remarks, a few of those awards that he didn't want to mention, and a little bit more of the biography. I also want to recognize two of our former Hilleman lecturers who are here with us in the audience, Dr. Alan Hinman and Dr. Paul Offit. And it's really a privilege to have Dr. Fauci as this year's Hilleman lecturer. I think many people know that Dr. Fauci traces his roots to Brooklyn. He made the massive journey from Brooklyn to Manhattan for his medical training at Cornell and his residency at the New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center. He then seemed to make the very large journey to Bethesda in 1968, and a man after my own heart, he has been there ever since with a huge commitment to growing an incredible portfolio of activities. For the last 25 years, he has been the director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And as someone who's in her fourth year as a center director, I like that kind of tenure. I definitely want to model that. He oversees a research portfolio of basic and applied research to prevent, diagnose, and treat HIV/AIDS, influenza, TB, malaria, and the agents of bioterrorism, as well as a broad range of infectious diseases. As you know, he's not only sought out by Mark's mother, he is also sought out by the White House, the Department of Health and Human Services, Congress, CNN. As someone who has had the privilege of testifying to Congress sitting next to Dr. Fauci, the best thing I can tell you is just to keep your own mouth shut, because he is just a phenomenal spokesperson for health for the country and for the U.S. government's role in that. I just want to express some personal gratitude to Dr. Fauci. The year he took over leadership at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, I was an intern in a New York City hospital where one-third of the patients we were caring for had this mysterious, terrible new disease. We could treat their toxoplasmosis and their cryptococcal meningitis and their PCP, but we had nothing to do for their underlying immune deficiency. And I think that 25 years later, the number of HIV antiretroviral drugs that are available, the care that people can receive here and around the world, as someone who still spends a little time at the Atlanta VA caring for adults with HIV, it's just miraculous what a difference we've seen. So much of that is the leadership that Dr. Fauci has shown, bringing academia, industry, and community groups together to advance health. So a few of those awards I just want to mention, in addition to the National Medal of Science, he's also inducted into the Institute of Medicine. I'm sorry, I'm advancing your slides. Okay, shall I just finish the talk? Okay. He's the recipient of the Mary Woodard Lasker Award for Public Service. You may know this as the American Nobel Prize. Again, the 34 honorary degrees. It's amazing. And I just want to say that this year's Hilleman Lecture is a true embodiment of science in the public interest, and it's a real privilege to welcome him. Join me in welcoming Dr. Fauci.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Julie, Anne, and Mark, for that very, very kind introduction. I appreciate it. It's a great privilege and a pleasure for me to be with you here tonight to deliver the Gerald Lynn Hilleman Lectureship for a number of reasons, probably the most important of which has been, as I'll get into in a moment, my very close, warm, and mentorship relationship that I had with Maurice during over 20 years of our interaction together. As you can see from this first title slide, I'm going to talk about the title of Vaccinology in the 21st Century, Classical Approaches and New Paradigms. And the reason I chose that is because I want to talk about the philosophical and pragmatic basis for some of the extraordinary successes that we have experienced. I'm sure most people in this room have had something directly or indirectly to do with the discovery and or implementation of these extraordinary successes, but also the challenges that we are now facing as we try very hard to push the envelope into greater discoveries and greater implementation for diseases that we have vaccines for but need better vaccines, and importantly, for the diseases that we do not have vaccines for. This slide here is very familiar, I'm sure, to virtually everybody in the room, because it's the success story slide of the impact of vaccines in the United States, but also globally. This slide specifically refers to the United States, and I know you're very familiar. If you look on the far right-hand column of this slide, the percent decreases in some of the classically and historically great infectious diseases killers, from measles and diphtheria through smallpox, Haemophilus influenza, and polio. Now, with regard to Maurice, again, as most of you know, Maurice has played a major role in the discovery of several of these vaccines. And again, it's such a privilege for me to give this lecture and put it in the context of what Maurice accomplished through his life. Many of you know, maybe not all, of what an extraordinary person he is. It says he is born in Miles City, Montana, and raised on a farm. For those of you who knew Maurice, he actually acted like a down-to-earth person who was raised on a farm. But he didn't take any nonsense from anyone, and he said it like it was and did not suffer fools lightly at all. And it was a lot of fun to see him enact that role that he so relished. But beyond that, he did a few other things. He developed around 40 vaccines and played a key role in more than half of the recommended childhood vaccines that we use here in the United States that are listed on this slide in the third bullet. He also did some fundamental basic science things about identifying shifts and drifts in the concepts of influenza, and was the discoverer or co-discoverer of other viruses for which he did not have a vaccine for, such as several adeno and rhinoviruses, SV40 and hepatitis A. It was a family affair for Maurice. This is a picture from several years ago of Maurice's daughter, Geraldine, for whom this lecture is named, who provided here in this picture what they call moral support for her son, who was vaccinated with the MMR vaccine that contained mumps vaccine made from the strain that Maurice got from Geraldine's throat when she had mumps. And it turns out that this is now a three-generation work here of the scholarship and public health awareness of Maurice Hilleman. And he did not spare himself from this. And this is just a picture of Maurice getting the experimental hepatitis B vaccine in the late 1970s. I had the opportunity, because I sought him out and he was very kind to me and my family, so that over so many years together and my admiring him up close and from a distance, that I had the privilege of giving the Laudatio in celebration of his 80th birthday in 2000, and then speaking in front of the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia in the Laudatio for Maurice Hilleman and his eulogy just following his death. And I said in the paper that was published in the Journal of Human Virology, and I mean this so sincerely, that one can say without hyperbole that Maurice has changed the world with his extraordinary contributions, and indeed he has. Now, what I mentioned in the first slide, that I'm going to talk about the philosophical and pragmatic aspects of classical vaccinology. And there was a paper that was written by Maurice over 10 years ago in Nature Medicine, in which he historically describes his experience with six decades of vaccine development. He called it a personal history. And speaking with Maurice so many times over the years and reading what he wrote, you can get a very good feel for what the challenges were and what the issues were in how we were successful in developing vaccines. And I'm going to use in a moment my own experience and those of my colleagues with HIV and other vaccines that we don't have yet in how we had to go beyond the classical paradigms. And as Maurice often told me, he said, much of vaccine, although vaccine development is really discovery and development, much of it really weighs heavily on development. Because discovery for him, although the developmental process had a lot of hiccups and was not an easy thing to do, discovery for him was fundamentally finding out what the microbe was and copying Mother Nature. So the common elements in classical vaccinology, as I mentioned, was discovery, defining and propagating the etiological agent. The classic example of the propagation long after the discovery was polio, and how that essentially led to the series of events that gave us a polio vaccine. You had to choose what candidate you want. Did you want live attenuated whole subunit? You maximized the immunogenicity, balanced against the reactogenicity. You did your preclinical and early clinical assessment. You proved protective efficacy and long-term immunity. You developed surrogate markers. And then you scaled up, you licensed, you manufactured, and you distributed. And it was in those steps that for so many years, the vaccine field has been so successful. And so when HIV came along, and this is now the very historic documents that introduced us to one of the most awful scourges that we've experienced in human history, is the HIV epidemic. And this is the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, the first report in June 5th of 1981. I remember very, very clearly sitting in my office at the clinical center at the NIH, reading the story of five gay men from LA who were otherwise well, who presented with pneumocystis carinii pneumonia. I thought about it for a few minutes. Isn't that unusual? All gay, otherwise well. I had been the infectious disease consult at the NIH because I was in NIAID, so I knew pneumocystis carinii pneumonia because we were treating cancer patients who were getting chemotherapy. So pneumocystis was not a surprise for me. It was a surprise for a lot of people on the outside that didn't treat immunosuppressed individuals. And I put it down and said, I don't know what it is, maybe a fluke drug. 4 weeks later, on the 4th of July, 26 additional individuals, again, all gay men, all otherwise well, only now in L.A., San Francisco, and New York, who presented with PCP as well as Kaposi sarcoma. That was the historic moment that actually set us on the trail of what I outlined before, first discovery and then development. This was the discovery. In May of 1983, Luc Montagnier and François Barré-Sinoussi identified a retrovirus from the lymph nodes of individuals who presented with this extraordinary syndrome, which at that time was called gay-related immunodeficiency, or GRID. It wasn't even called AIDS then. 1 year later, in 1984, there were a number of papers, predominantly from Bob Gallo's lab, which actually made the causal etiological relationship with that virus and the syndrome, which we now called AIDS. So if you look back at what that meant for us, that meant we had the first bullet on that slide. We had the discovery. So now the question is, develop a vaccine, which actually led to the now somewhat embarrassing statement that Margaret Heckler, when she was the Secretary of HHS, meant, but in fairness to her, it wasn't so far off. She said, we hope to have a vaccine against AIDS ready for testing in about 2 years, which if you look at the discovery development paradigm, that is not such an unreasonable prediction to make, that you would have it at least ready for testing. And as a matter of fact, many people who look at this and say, what a pathetic situation, she actually was right. It was ready for testing, but we had no idea of what we were doing because we were following the classical type of an approach of vaccine development. Now, what do we mean by that? And here's where we went wrong because we followed it because we had no other alternative. In classic vaccinology, there's what we call a proof of concept, and nature provides the proof of concept for you, namely that the response to natural infection is actually a very, very competent response. If you look at four of the diseases in which we have very good vaccines for, and you look at these diseases, they have a common denominator. They have variable courses and sequelae, some of them extremely serious, like polio, some with a mortality that, although relatively speaking is not that high, 15 to 20% is pretty high, smallpox. However, the important thing that we take for granted that vaccinology is based on is that the vast majority of people spontaneously recover. And when they recover, the virus is ultimately cleared, and in fact, it's eradicated. And protective immunity against subsequent infection is usually complete and often lifelong. So the proof of concept that a vaccine is possible if you mimic natural infection and don't kill and or hurt your patient, you're going to have a vaccine. However, HIV, we weren't completely aware of it back in 1983, 84, but now in 2009, it is very clear that HIV is different because with few exceptions, the disease is relentlessly progressive and virtually no one completely recovers spontaneously. I reuse the word virtually because you never say never and never say always, but nobody spontaneously recovers, at least that I've had any experience with. You have long-term non-progressors who control it, but there are no documented cases of anybody with established infection who's actually eradicated the virus from their body. Send them to my lab, we'll do PCR, we will find the virus for sure. There are no instances of that. Importantly, protective immunity does not appear to exist. There's relative protection against progression, but immunity that does what we do with polio, smallpox, measles, does not occur with HIV. And so, if you juxtapose them together, classical vaccinology for the viruses that I mentioned earlier proved the concept. Use Maurice's model. You've discovered the microbe, develop a vaccine. HIV vaccinology, We were swimming in the dark. There was no proof of concept. So what we did is that we looked at what the licensed vaccines' success stories were, attenuated and activated extracts, and then defined immunogens. So we used hepatitis B as the model. If you could get a recombinant protein and you could have a successful vaccine, why not with HIV? So among the spectrum of the different strategies, we started off with a viral surface protein with the hope of eliciting neutralizing antibodies. And that's where the saga started. And in fact, as shown on this historic slide, it was a release from HHS in 1987. Remember, HIV was proven to be the cause of AIDS in 1984 in a paper in Science. 3 years later, tip your hat to Margaret Heckler, this was, in fact, in clinical trial. The problem is as we were putting the vaccine into clinical trial, basic scientists among us, myself included, were observing that neutralizing antibody did not neutralize primary isolates. It only neutralized lab-adapted isolates. And neutralizing antibody that the individuals had who were infected did not even neutralize their own strain in their body. So something was terribly wrong, but we proceeded ahead because we had no other option. And in fact, in a New York Times article 21 years ago, Maurice himself, getting back to his classical vaccinology, said that I don't know of anything like it, said Maurice Hilleman, a vaccine researcher with 45 years of experience who was the director of the Merck Institute. This is the first time in vaccine development that neutralizing antibodies don't seem to amount to much. So I asked Maurice what he meant by that. He said, I've never seen anything like this where either you don't get neutralizing antibodies or when you do, they don't do anything, which is a very interesting phenomenon. Again, the train was out of the station. And so a couple of trials started off and went to a advanced phase 3 or maybe phase 2B, if you want to call it that. They were the recombinant clade B vaccine trial among men who have sex with men, performed in the United States, Canada, Puerto Rico, and Europe, and one that was performed in Thailand. And the results of those came out 4 to 5 years ago. And you see here, both published in the Journal of Infectious Diseases, these were antibody-based vaccines. They did not induce cell-mediated immunity. They were antibody-based vaccines. And in fact, they were complete failures. They had no protective effect whatsoever. What was evolving during the middle of these trials was the concept fundamentally observed in animals that maybe we should accept a new paradigm while we're trying to figure out this antibody deal, and perhaps cell-mediated immunity, which may not protect against infection, could blunt the disease progression, including the initial spike of viremia, where 65 to 75% of transmissions occur from a person who's experiencing acute infection, and then later on to keep the virus low, with a two-pronged effect. Now, we saw this in animals, and it seemed to work. The problem with the animal model is that we were using homologous and not heterologous challenges. A big deal, because the mother of all heterologous challenges is HIV with all of its variability in the wild. But nonetheless, because of this, and I think with some good reason, trials went forth. And it was based on the concept that if this is a typical course of an infected person who was not vaccinated, you get the burst of viremia, then you settle off at a set point, as it's called, which can be high in some people, hundreds of thousands of copies, or as low as 5,000 to 10,000 copies. And then you wind up the terminal part of the disease when you have breakthrough. The thought being that if you vaccinate someone and no one really feels that you're going to protect against infection by a T-cell vaccine, because T-cells work by destroying viral infected cells, so you have to have gotten infected anyway. So the thought was that we could blunt the initial burst of viremia and then keep the level of virus so low that you had two good effects. The person could spend many years without requiring therapy, and two, they wouldn't be infecting other people. It was tried, but unfortunately, it failed. And I'm sure many of you know of the trial that was sponsored by Merck that was done in collaboration with the NIH-sponsored trial network in which an adeno-5 vector expressing the GAG pollen neph of a clade B was used, and there were two separate studies, one in a study in America, in the United States, and one in Africa. It did not accomplish the endpoint of certainly not blocking infection, but it had no effect on the set point. And there was a very curious, interesting situation where people who had a high titers for adenovirus 5, as well as being uncircumcised, who actually had what looked like a greater propensity of getting infected upon exposure. So that put a real big damper on that. So now what? We asked not too long ago. We had a meeting in Bethesda. A number of Mark was there, others were there. And what we said, since natural infection, so we dialed back the clock and saying, okay, we did the classical vaccinology thing and it didn't work. Not that we're going to abandon classical vaccinology, because there's so much about what's classically done that we're still going to have to do. But since natural infection did not provide the proof of concept, the scientific community had to do it. So the many tools of vaccine science are going to have to be looked at and perhaps used here to push the envelope forward. We had a meeting in March of 08. In July of 08, we published a number of important issues that needed to be addressed before we went forward with larger clinical trials. So what we did is that we took the original model, which Maurice taught me and taught so many of us, which heavily weighted towards development once you made the fundamental discovery, and we turned the knob back to discovery and started to ask some fundamental questions. Looking at the early events, I'm going to get to that in a second. The early events in HIV infection are absolutely critical and are quite different than any other viral infection that I know of. The issue with mucosal immunity has some overlap with a lot of other infections in which the mucosa is the site of entry. We had to look at neutralizing antibodies and finally ask the question, why don't we make neutralizing antibodies against HIV? Why is that so? Why does the body not seem to want to make effective neutralizing antibodies? What about innate immune responses, which was in the realm of fundamental basic immunology, but has not really been a serious consideration in vaccinology up to now? What about perfecting the animal models, the correlates of immune protection, and try and get some new fresh blood in the field, people who haven't had years of successful experience with the classical approach? So the first question that was asked is, how can we close the early window of vulnerability in HIV infection? Again, if you go back to this model, what you see when the virus enters the body, literally within days, you have the establishment of a non-eradicable reservoir. And when I say non-eradicable, I mean up to now non-eradicable, in that it inserts itself into the genome of the cell, and we and others have been working on this for years. It happens very, very early on. You destroy predominantly gut-associated lymphoid tissue, but it disseminates to the rest of the body and seems to selectively knock out HIV-specific CD4-positive T cells, which are the driving force for the immune response to get a good vaccine going. Now, the thing about it that's so different and so challenging that I have to tell you today on the 30th of March of 2009 that I don't know if we're ever going to overcome this challenge. And that is that once the virus gets in, it appears, though not completely, that the horse is out of the barn. Take polio. If you look at polio in people with vaccine-induced immunity, the polio virus replicates at different sites, but it is neutralized before it reaches its ultimate target, namely the anterior horn cells in the spinal cord. So you could have several rounds of replication, and the ball game is not over with polio. Polio is a highly successful vaccine, and yet when we get the virus in our GI tract, it replicates before it gets to the anterior horn cells. Rabies, the whole concept of vaccinating rabies is the successes that we've had after someone gets exposed. Again, because you have multiple opportunities to block the end organ target vulnerability before the virus then is beyond the scope of the vaccine. Smallpox, and we had a lot of this when we spent a lot of time in 2001, 2, and 3, following the anthrax attack, of trying to figure out whether we should have 300 million doses of smallpox vaccine when we only had 18 million in our stockpile. And the answer was, the reason we did it, and we do now have over 300 million doses of smallpox is that even following an attack, if you look at this slide, there are several points before you get clinical disease of smallpox where you can vaccinate somebody days after exposure and with the virus replicating still prevent disease. That is absolutely impossible at this point in time with HIV for the reasons that I mentioned. Literally within days, the virus is there, it goes to a latent form or even an activated replicated form, and it just keeps propagating itself, and there has been no successes in eradicating it up to this point. And we published this, but a number of others have, and this is a paper from 11 years ago where we looked at people who both had acute infection and those in which we suppressed their virus with antiretrovirals, then empirically stopped therapy. The spike of viremia came back, and we immediately measured the size of the reservoir, and the size of the reservoir would double or triple within a day following the burst of viremia. So that's a pretty tough nut to crack. So what has happened now is that with this relooking at discovery, we're focusing a lot more on this issue of neutralizing antibodies. And a number of investigators, David Montefiore and John Mascola and others, recently published about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, that in fact, they feel, and we do, that an optimally effective HIV vaccine must elicit potent antiviral neutralizing antibodies. You may need cell-mediated immunity also, but you absolutely needed neutralizing antibodies. So what investigators have done is they've gone back and looked at those very rare neutralizing antibodies that have occurred for which we now have monoclonal antibodies against. Not everybody makes them. And we've been able to identify, we in the field, what the binding epitopes are of those neutralizing antibodies. And some are the CD4 binding site, some are areas in the proximal membrane external domain of the GP41, but they do exist. And most recently, literally, just a few days ago in Nature, Michelle Nutzenzweig published that, in fact, if you look carefully enough, there are a broad diversity of neutralizing antibodies that you are able to isolate directly from memory B cells. So if you go into the plasma and look for it, you're not going to find them. But if you actually get the B cells and clone them out and look for these neutralizing antibodies, they're there. So there are going to be many, many more sites that we can identify what that structural epitope is that we can then use it as an immunogen. I can tell you ahead of time, it's not going to be that easy because even having already tried with the monoclonal antibodies that we have, that they're not particularly immunogenic after you scaffold them, namely the epitope that's identified by the monoclonal antibody. So let's move quickly on to an area that's very exciting in basic immunology, but hasn't been specifically utilized in vaccinology. And that is the issue of the innate immune system and its connection with the development of adaptive immune responses. The potential role for the innate immune system in vaccine-related protection against HIV is to lessen that gap of vulnerability in acute infection, those few days that, as I keep mentioning, the horse is out of the barn after the first few rounds of replication, but also to serve as a way to develop adjuvants for the establishment of adaptive immunity. And we know that if you look carefully at the innate immune system, it has multiple components, all of which now we at NIAID are putting a lot of resources in getting investigators, particularly new investigators, immunologists who have not been involved in the field, to study the cellular, extracellular, and even intracellular components of innate immunity that we may be able to harness that for the development of an HIV vaccine. So before I leave HIV and go on to briefly to some other examples, I keep that's the question that I used to get asked all the time is, when are we going to have a cure for HIV? Now we got great drugs. We haven't cured it, but we have really good drugs. Now the most common question is, are we ever going to have an HIV vaccine? Well, I think the best case scenario is that we'll have a high percentage of protection against acquisition. I think right now with what we have, I don't see that happening. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen, but with the tools and the knowledge that we have, I think the trial and error situation is beyond us now. We have to really discover some of those issues that I mentioned. Will we have protection against acquisition in only some individuals that might be related to their genetic profile? I think that's much more possible, because if you go back and examine the data from the Merck trial and you look at those individuals that actually seem to have a good immune response, those individuals fell within the genetic profile of people who in fact turned out to be elite non-progressives. Not all of them, but some of them, which tells you that there clearly is a genetic component here. So we may see a vaccine that works for a subset of genetically pre-programmed individuals, which isn't usually the case with vaccines in general. And then we may have slowing of progression of diseases, I'm not sure. So let's leave HIV now and say that there are obviously a lot of other infections that very well may pose the same sort of challenges, but a little bit different, maybe not the reservoir or whatever, but other challenges that we have to now go beyond the classical approach and do some serious discovery. The first thing I always do when I talk about that is, what is the need? The need is overwhelming. I don't need to tell this audience, of the 58 million deaths a year, 24 to 25% of them are caused by infectious diseases. And among those listed on this slide are several that we don't have vaccines for. The other whole issue of the delivery of vaccines that we do have a vaccine for is a very serious problem, but there are some here that we do not have a vaccine for. Not to mention the emerging and re-emerging infections, and this is just a slide that I update every year and show it to the Congress when I talk about why they need to fund infectious diseases, that every year we get one, sometimes two, sometimes three new infections to the point where you can barely read the slide. I first made the slide, actually, in 1983, when we had HIV, and I've been adding to it ever since, and you can see there it's a pretty busy slide. So let's look at where we're going to be going now. How are we going to apply this new science to an old and revered discipline, the discipline of successful vaccinology that Maurice essentially spent his entire life in making a beautiful example of? First is the whole issue of genomics, the ability to express proteins by isolating the genes or microarraying the genes or reverse vaccinologying the genes, a very important approach that we have not used successfully yet except for one vaccine that I'll mention to. The structure-based vaccine design, crystallographic structure and identification of epitopes, particularly those that bind to neutralizing antibodies. The whole issue of nanotechnology and systems biology, a number of vectors, new delivery, the production technology, we saw it very clearly with influenza when we made the shift, which is almost there now, from egg-based to cell-based production to take the uncertainty out of it and to be able to scale up rapidly. And then finally, I'm going to spend a minute or so on the issue of adjuvants. So let's look at the issue of what genomics has allowed us to do. The question of reverse vaccinology, namely to search the entire genetic repertoire of a pathogen for a protective antigen, which was done very clearly and published a couple of years ago with Group B strep, in which all of the expressed proteins were able to be used as immunogens and then pooled what the best of those were, and you had four or five of them, and we had a very, very good vaccine against Group B strep that actually was broadly protective, which was one of the big stumbling blocks of Group B streptococcal vaccines. The other gets back to what I mentioned just a little while ago with HIV, because you now can take the envelope and its binding to CD4 after it induces a conformational change and exposes a cryptic epitope that actually is the neutralizing epitope, in addition to other components of the envelope of HIV. And by crystallographic and atomic structure examination, you can create an epitope that should be able to theoretically induce a neutralizing antibody. The problem is that you got to get it in an immunogenic form, and that actually has not been as easy as I thought it was going to be, but I think it can be done. The other, and we saw this, and this is just one of about three papers that have come out over the last year and a half, is the use of combinatorial libraries. This is from a survivor, survivors of H5N1 avian flu in Turkey, but now you can even get it from individuals who are non-immune and non-exposed. In other words, ask your combinatorial library to give you every conceivable specificity of a particular microbe and to then either screen or use that as immunogens in your vaccination. That's a way that's going to revolutionize how we look at vaccinology. And then the issue of adjuvants. I introduced adjuvants before when we spoke for a few minutes about the innate and the adaptive immune system, but there really is a new paradigm now in vaccinology that's going to impact all the new vaccines that we make. The old perspective, classically, was that the antigen itself was sufficient to induce a protective response. The new perspective is that adjuvants, either endogenous or exogenous, can actually contribute to the breadth and the depth and hence the efficacy of a vaccine. We now, particularly with influenza, are adding adjuvants and other immunomodulators, which may be necessary for an optimal response, and we've had some significant success with influenza, and the product development pathway is changing. You either put the adjuvant in or you have a mix and match where you prove the efficacy of the adjuvant, and then right at the point of delivery, you actually put the adjuvant in. Now, I'm going to give you an example very, very briefly, is that some of you may remember a few years ago when the H5N1 situation was hot. It's still existent. It isn't hot in the press anymore. Nothing has changed. We still have a dribbling of cases coming in, but we're not paying that much attention to it. But back then, the issue was to develop a vaccine against H5N1, which isn't particularly immunogenic, and there wasn't a lot of cross-reactivity. So a vaccine was successfully made, published in the New England Journal in March 3 years ago. That was the good news. The sobering news is that it took 290 microgram doses that would induce a response in 50% of the volunteers. So although it was hailed and in some respects was a big success, it wasn't particularly good. 50% of people, you need more antigen than you've ever used in any influenza vaccine. But it was a good start. When vaccines were used by a number of companies, we now know that you can actually use a fraction of that amount and get responses in more than 75 and sometimes up to 90% of individuals. So you've done two things. You've broadened the scope of it from 50 to close to 90, and you have a fraction of what you need. Why is that important? It has major implications for the stockpiling of pre-pandemic vaccines. The other thing is, much to our, I would say, gratification, maybe surprise, if you're honest, it was a surprise. I wasn't sure it was going to happen, that they're actually now cross-reacting. So you could vaccinate against a Vietnam strain without an adjuvant, get no cross-reactivity, put an adjuvant in, you get it against a Hong Kong strain and an Indonesian strain. So adjuvant not only allows you a lower dose, but it also increases the scope of it. So now our stockpile of 22 million 90 microgram doses, when you add adjuvant, you actually have hundreds of millions of doses. So the concern about stockpiling in a pre-pandemic, particularly since you're going to get cross-reactivity, is a major use of adjuvants. Now, adjuvants, as you know, were kind of black magic years ago. You put Freund's adjuvant, complete or incomplete, into a rabbit or a guinea pig, and you get this great response. Nobody knew how it worked. So now it's becoming very sophisticated, and we do have the molecular mechanisms of adjuvant effect pretty well worked out, at least a very good start on it, and understanding the toll-like receptors, which are the pattern recognition molecules. This is what it looked like from a paper of Medzikoff and Charlie Janeway in 2000. And if you look at this slide, from 2000 until just last year, the number of publications on innate immunity has increased dramatically so that the scheme looks like this now. So we haven't even begun to garner the advantage of understanding the whole situation with adjuvants. And in this slide is a pipeline of some new adjuvants, and I'm not going to go through each and every one of them, but as you can see, for the most part, they're related to now the very complex unfolding issues of toll-like receptors and how signaling through these receptors markedly enhances the immune response as well as leads as a segue to adaptive immunity. I want to spend the last few minutes on tuberculosis and malaria, because if ever there were a couple of diseases that have really defied our ability to successfully make a vaccine for a public health problem that is within the short list, the top three or four of what we really need a vaccine for. So I'm going to spend a couple of minutes on that. Tuberculosis, you're all aware of. Extraordinary disease burden, 9.3 million new cases a year, 1.7 million deaths, 500,000 new cases of multiple drug-resistant, and about 50 countries have extensively drug-resistant TB. It is a problem. We have a vaccine, BCG. It doesn't work against adult respiratory tuberculosis. it is somewhat efficacious in childhood meningeal tuberculosis, but it doesn't work very well to prevent tuberculosis in an adult. What are the barriers to the development of tuberculosis vaccine? The correlates of protective immunity are not known. So all of a sudden, we have an HIV-like phenomenon that we don't know what we're dealing with. So if we're going to try and induce a protective immunity, we need to know what it is. The other is that we have multiple stages of disease and pathological lesions, from latency through very robust replication. Placebo-controlled clinical trials are difficult. We have an existing BCG that's routinely used in children in certain parts of the world. Also, animal models may not necessarily predict very well. So what are the progress in TB? First of all, I mentioned we've got to turn that knob, which is what we are, to try and determine precisely what the immune correlates are so that can we do what we're starting to do with HIV. Also, we're starting to use some of the novel vectors, the MVA, the modified vaccinia ankara, as a vector for a TB antigen. Adjuvanted protein vaccines are in phase 2 trial, and we're going back to BCG in a phase 1 and a recombinant BCG. Malaria. Malaria is an extraordinary disease. I don't need to tell this audience this. A little bit less than 1 million deaths each year, mostly in African children less than 5 years old. It's present in 109 countries and territories, and half the world's population is at risk. Again, there are challenges. It is a very large eukaryotic genome with many genes, a complex life cycle with differential gene expression. We don't have good culture systems. We know that some protective immunity exists. It doesn't exist very well in children. That's why they get severe malaria and die. But after you've been infected multiple times and you go beyond adolescent, you don't protect against infection, but you protect against disease. That's a fascinating situation. It takes a couple of decades to get there. But when you get there, you don't get sick. Mostly don't get sick, but you do get infected. So all of our friends that we visit in Africa, our African scientific colleagues, they probably all have parasites running around, malaria in their blood, but they don't get sick. That's very, very clear. That's not made up. That's exactly what happens. If we could understand that with those correlates of immunity that protects them from getting sick, we'll be much closer to the development of a malaria vaccine. And also, there are some technological issues that I mentioned earlier. So what are some of the recent advances? Some of you in the room are familiar with it. The RTSS, the GlaxoSmithKline vaccine, a subunit for Plasmodium falciparum. It's based on a recombinant protein of a viral-like particle, very similar to the hepatitis B situation. There's some exciting work coming from Steve Hoffman, in which he's irradiating mosquitoes that contain the sporozoites, essentially getting an attenuated sporozoite vaccine, which looks very good in very early trials, as well as a number of vector vaccines for malaria. So the opportunities are actually breathtaking, and that's the reason why I'm so excited about what is going on right now in vaccinology as we move towards the very classical, highly successful approach that we've had for so many decades that Maurice himself has played such a major role in. But before I close, I do want to mention something that, with all his great discoveries and development, whenever we would discuss vaccines with Maurice, he would bring something up that I would like to end with you on. And that is, we're talking about research and development successes in the future based on research and development successes in the past. But the one thing that we must do better on, and that Maurice actually recognized, is that if you look at the unrealized life-saving potential of vaccines that Maurice himself developed, and I just picked out three that he played a major role in, pneumococcal, hepatitis B, HIV, and measles, these are the number of deaths of people who would not have died had a vaccine been made available to them. So although I've been speaking about research and development for this past 45 minutes, we should not forget that there's another big problem, and that's getting the fruits of the research and development to the people who need them. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to congratulate Dr. Fauci for his many years of service and for sharing just a fraction of his expert experience with us here tonight. I think it's a real gift, his gift in the world of science, but the gift that he can make us all understand it is maybe even greater, certainly for me. So again, the Hillman Lectureship honors an outstanding individual who, through their work or leadership, makes significant contributions to the prevention of disease through immunization. I think Dr. Fauci is an outstanding example.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd also like to thank the staff at CDC, at Merck, and at the CDC Foundation who helped in all the behind-the-scenes planning for this evening, and to thank the members of the Hillman Lectureship Planning Committee, of which Dr. Feinberg and Dr. Schuchat are members.